From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Neil Thomas, author of the new book, Taking Leave of Darwin, A Longtime Agnostic Discovers the Case for Design. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Professor Thomas in their conversation.
Many of those so-called disciples of Darwin were interested in advancing a form of theistic evolution for the very reasons that you've given, that while what we observe today might go on naturalistically, there must have been an initial impetus to give it shape and form and the kind of complexity that you refer to there. So I think possibly the kind of gimlet-eyed doctrinaire zealots that we associate with Darwinism these days, and you may know who I'm talking about, but I will not mention his name.
Does it start with a D?
It might well. We're not represented so much until the period after the so-called New Synthesis, after the 1920s. I think really from 1860 to 1920, Darwinian ideas were debated as part of a discussion document. That's how many people regarded it. And even Darwin himself, you remember, he issued 6 editions in all of his Origin of Species, each time trying to sort of make things right with those people who had disagreed with this, that, and the other. And so it's as if he himself was not sure of his own ground. And I mean, one of the ways that he wasn't sure of his own ground was the whole matter of his Christian faith, which has been done to death, I'm aware, many times. But I think it is worth talking about maybe in this context, because he had this kind of riven mind about it. He was, one foot was in the sort of the Christian camp and the other in the atheist camp. And he wasn't really able to square those things, to reconcile those two things, right up until the date of his death in 1882. And we may think, well, this is a bit funny, isn't it? Because intelligent people usually come to some kind of resolution of their crises of faith or whatever they are. But that's not necessarily the case, because one of Darwin's near contemporaries, George Eliot, Marianne Evans, the author who took a male pseudonym, is known for having been a great agnostic, humanist, you call it what you like. But as a critical cockshoot pointed out many years ago, in 1964, in his book on the English agnostics, that Marianne Evans, George Eliot, even though, the way he puts it, even though she gave up a formal belief in Christian faith and so on, she yet held on very vividly to a notion of providence, the idea that things were going to go in the right direction. And that is only really possible, if you think about it, if you have some kind of residual sort of faith. And I think the same can be applied, mutatis mutandis, to Darwin. He was a Victorian as well. They were of the same generation. And this was the kind of thought way of that particular zeitgeist.
And I think one of the things that ought to be pointed out is that it seems to me that Darwin, as you point out, was involved in the Christian faith. In fact, he said that when he set out on the HMS Beagle, he was a Bible-believing creationist, and he said he did not then, at that point, doubt the strict and literal truth of every word in the Bible. Now, what's interesting about that is it seems to me that Darwin read the Bible in a wooden literalistic fashion, out of which comes nothing but nonsense. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing applies to how he read the book of nature. So he read the Bible incorrectly, but he also read the book of nature incorrectly. Both are a fundamentalism. A fundamentalism, you might say, on the right and a fundamentalism on the left, but both fundamentalism, not following truth wherever it leads, but rather reading something in a way that it ought not to be read. And as a result of that, I mean, there are people like Malcolm Muggeridge who say that science could be as dogmatic as any church and with less justification, and its devotees as bigoted as any country clergyman, a quote that you have in the book.
Yes, that's right. He did write that in a biography, yes, Samuel Butler, yeah. I think that people have tried to disentangle the confusions of Darwin's religious views many times over. And I must say that I think that we have to accept that, I think there was an American critic called Neil Gillespie who wrote about his epistemological double vision, that he retained that to the end of his days. I mean, in my latest book, what I've been quite fascinated, I mean, it's one of the cases where my previous incarnation as a literary critic has come in. When Darwin, and nobody else has commented on this as far as I know, when Darwin went aboard the Beagle originally in the 1830s, one of the books that he took with him, and he said it was his most favorite resource or some words to that effect, was Milton's Paradise Lost. Now, the point about Milton's Paradise Lost, it's an absolutely gorgeous verse epic. It's a bit like hearing organ music, it's most sonorous in English verse. But the point about Paradise Lost is that many people, Milton himself, said that he was writing it as a theodicy to justify the works of God to men, as he put it in his introduction. But some later critics, and not only just later critics, but many contemporary critics, and most signally an English critic of the 1930s called William Empson, in his book called Milton's God, have suggested quite the opposite, that the true hero of Paradise Lost is not God, who comes over as a rather legalistic kind of person, I have to admit, but rather Satan himself, who is this kind of rebel thrown out of heaven with the rebellious angels, and some of whose lines are really worthy of all revolutionaries, some modern like Che Guevara or whoever you like. They are sort of classic incendiary revolutionary rhetoric. And William Empson and others have said that this is really where Darwin was at. He had a kind of grudging respect for Satan as the one who had set himself up against the Christian God. So I think one has to conclude at the end of the day that Darwin's thinking, such as it was a bit of a mess. He was not a crisp theologian. He wasn't a really sharp conceptual thinker or philosopher in the way that we would define that term in the 20th and 21st centuries. He was somebody who simply suffered with the rest of us sometimes as not knowing quite what they meant or even where they were coming from. Mentally me speaking, that is, spiritually speaking.
Well said. I want to talk about the fossil record, something that you address in the book. Carl Linnaeus, who is the father of biological taxonomy, he made it plain in the 18th century that species do not change and that all living things were created as they can be observed today.
Yes.
So the fossil record, according to Carl Linnaeus, says no to the Darwinian superstructure. It is in direct contrast with what Darwin said. And as you look farther into the fossil record, you see that the fossil record has been an embarrassment to Darwin. Darwin had an excuse, I've often said, but people like Dawkins do not. The fossil record is an embarrassment to Darwinian evolution.
Yes, It was very much an embarrassment to Darwin. He actually adverts to it very directly in his Origin of Species when he says that one would expect that nature would be in an uproar, that we would have a process of gradual hybridization with gradations between species, and that this would be reflected in the fossil record. Well, of course, the fossil record does not reflect that at all. It is most un-Darwinian. I mean, after the so-called Cambrian explosion 540 million years ago, you have a sudden appearance of fully formed species. And this is very difficult to account for, which is why Stephen Jay Gould and Eldridge came out with their alternative theory of punctuated equilibrium, as you'll know very well, that perhaps evolution was not as gradual as Darwin would like it to have been. But he was aware of it. But the strange thing is that he's very open-hearted about it. He brings this into his book. And I sometimes wonder whether this is the reason that people have forgiven him this inconsistency, because he was so transparent and so honest that they've given him a pass on that, which is rather silly because, you know, to give somebody a pass on something of such importance, it's not a matter of sportsmanship. It's a matter of truth, isn't it?
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Neil Thomas. In his new book, Taking Leave of Darwin, University Professor Neil Thomas, a rationalist and humanist, explains how researching and writing about evolutionary theory has brought him to a place he would have found surprising before embarking on the project, especially regarding the intersection of science and religion. Indeed, concludes Thomas, with the naturalistic, materialistic alternative having failed so significantly, we are left with no other choice but to consider the possibility of the God hypothesis. To receive your copy of Taking Leave of Darwin, A Longtime Agnostic Discovers the Case for Design by Neil Thomas, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal, just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org.
University Professor Neil Thomas was a committed Darwinist and agnostic until an investigation of evolutionary theory led him to the startling conclusion that he had been conned. As he studied the work of Darwin's defenders, he found himself encountering tactics eerily similar to the methods of political brainwashing he had studied as a scholar. Thomas felt impelled to write a book as a sort of warning call to humanity. Beware, you have been fooled. The result is Taking Leave of Darwin, a fascinating history and analysis of the evolution debate, written in exquisite prose. Thomas shows that objections to evolutionary theory raised by Darwin's own contemporaries have never been effectively answered. To receive your copy of Taking Leave of Darwin, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Professor Neil Thomas, as they continue their conversation.
I think what's really important, and you've alluded to Richard Dawkins, but here you have Darwin's best-known modern expositor, who is, from my perspective, and I think from yours as well, essentially deceitful and illogical. He is a person who knows about molecular biology, which shows that the humblest bacterium contains more genetic information than the instruction manual for NASA space probes. So he's aware of things that Darwin was not aware of.
Yes.
And yet he continues to hoodwink people.
Yes. I mean, the point is, I don't know whether he's hoodwinking other people as much as he's hoodwinking himself, to be honest. I think he is doctrinaire. I think he is a zealot, but I would hesitate to accuse him of dishonesty in that precise sense, because I think that he is so overinvested in the idea that he is not trying to fool other people so much as he's trying to fool himself. I mean, one of the things that he said in either The Blind Watchmaker, I think it was The Blind Watchmaker rather than Climbing Mount Improbable, was that this whole business about so-called abiogenesis, the emergence of life from chemical combinations and reactions, that he said, well, we haven't managed to do this yet. There are all sorts of other irons in the fire, like thermal vents and so on, where we're hoping that some clues might come. And then he says, rather piteously at the end, we haven't had such a result so far, but perhaps we will in the future. Well, this kind of promissory note on what might happen in the future, it sounds a bit pathetic to me. And it sounds to me like somebody who is so desperate to have his version of things represented in the historical record that he can't actually see behind it or beyond it to give a sense of perspective. And I'm surprised, as you are, that people, especially since the invention of the electron microscope in the mid-1940s and its implementation. I mean, the idea of the various micro-universes that have come into being that Darwin couldn't have known about, but which we know about full well. And you would think, yes, people would factor that into their analyses. But the old guard apparently do not. And it's a matter of regret, but there's nothing that you or I can do about it, presumably.
Yeah, you know, to be an evolutionist today, you have to believe that nothing creates everything, that life comes from non-life, and that the life that comes from non-life created metaphysical realities. And yet, as Louis Pasteur made plain, only life can produce life. And
yes.
I bring this up in the context of the 1953 Miller-Urey experiment, which Time magazine breathlessly touted as a major breakthrough. So now, for the first time, we have evidence that non-life can produce life. Talk about the misinformation with respect to that experiment.
Yes, it was done by two reputable scientists in the University of Chicago, as you know. And it was really an attempt to defy what I would call the triple lock, which had been put on the idea of life coming from non-life, which came not only from Pasteur in the 19th century, but from the British scientist William Harvey, who discovered the circulation of blood back in the 17th century, and also by the Italian Francesco Redi, which is why I call it a triple lock. All of them found that experiments to try and indicate that life could, I don't know, emerge from salt, linen or whatever, were absolute nonsense. This could not happen. And I think, really, it's a very strange one. It's one of these false scientific ideas that's put into a kind of cryogenic freezing, or it's put on a kind of life support mechanism, intellectually speaking. And what happened, I think, in the 20th century, which became essentially for many people a non-Christian century, was that Haldane and Oparin, British and Russian scientists, had said in the 1920s that well, perhaps we could see whether this works, you know, after all. And I think what happened was that the idea didn't die out completely, because there was a really bizarre experiment in 1947 in the University of California, carried out by one Robert Cornish, to try and resuscitate an executed criminal. And he would have gone ahead with that had not the university authorities rather sensibly stood in to stop him. Anyway, all this was the prelude, I think, to the Miller-Urey experiment of 1953, which again tried to flout all respectable and not just empirically proven scientific findings about whether life could come from non-life. It was an heroic experiment. It didn't work. People wanted it to work. They willed it to work so hard that some people like Carl Sagan said, rather hopefully, that it had worked in a manner of speaking. Well, it didn't really. And one of the things that I noticed is that some time ago, almost half a century ago, one has to say now, the film came out, a Mel Brooks film, a comedy called Young Frankenstein, which is all about, you know, original Mary Frankenstein thing and about whether you can bring back a creature to life, or, and by implication, whether you can create life and so on. And you may know the film, others may know the film. It's very entertaining. There's a lot of goonery in it, a lot of nonsense in it. But at the end of the day, when Mel Brooks was interviewed for a biography in 2019, he said there was a serious purpose in this, and that was to satirize the idea that life could come from non-life. He felt that this was illegitimately trying to play God, or words to that effect, is what he said to the journalist who was interviewing him in 2019. So I think it's a very strange one. People will have beliefs that are not borne out by the evidence, but which they still hold on to, because I think it promises a kind of materialistic explanation for reality, which unfortunately for them is not there.
Yeah, it's not there. And so there is this grasping at straws. One of the examples of that would be panspermia. This has become a very popular explanation for the origin of life on Earth. Mm-hmm. Talk about panspermia. A lot of people may not know the term.
No.
But this is something that has become increasingly popular in our era, both from the perspective of directed panspermia and, you know, the notion that this just wafted in our direction as a result of meteors.
Yes. Again, this is a very strange one. I would again say, perhaps rather, I hope I'm not being too insulting when I say it, but I think it is one of these ideas that's kept alive artificially as a sort of cryogenic experiment in a way, because what happened was that even going back to 1903, when the idea in the modern era was put forward of panspermia, of the what it means is that life, people having given up the idea of trying to look for some chemical abiogenesis on Earth, have said, oh, well, maybe life appeared from outer space. And so what happened was that the idea was, and it's a purely theoretical one, it's a bit like the multiverse, it only exists in people's imagination. And that is that life could have been so seeded from outer space as a result of the equivalent of convection currents. You know, this sort of life could have been crusted in a boulder or something as a meteorite, and then somehow found itself here on Earth. So the person who had a very strange relationship with the idea of panspermia was the legendary British cosmologist Sir Fred Hoyle. who himself is on record as having said there's nothing so stupid in science as the idea that a random coming together of chemicals could produce the first cells of life here on Earth. But apparently he did not wish to risk his scientific good name by implying that there was some kind of God explanation for things. And so he succumbed to the temptations of putting forward panspermia as an idea of his own. He actually lent his prestigious name to this rather lunatic, it seems to me, idea. And it goes to show, I think, that when we're in the dark about things, we can reach out, as you say, for the most strange straws to cling on to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking also about how you have been able to sift through all of this, and you have a chapter in your book on the challenge of intelligent design. And So many people today are saying that the intelligent design theorists, many of whom are my friends, that they're smuggling religion into the picture under the banner of scientific credibility. And nothing could be farther from the truth.
We'll have to stop here for today's edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Neil Thomas, a committed Darwinist and agnostic, until an investigation of evolutionary theory led him to a startling conclusion that he had been fooled. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping outreaches, Hank would like to send you Neil Thomas's book, Taking Leave of Darwin, A Longtime Agnostic Discovers the Case for Design. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.